John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. Gordon Chang, at Gordon G. Chang, Gatestone, Newsweek, and The Hill is with me as my colleague, because we're very keen on the visit of the new Japanese Prime Minister to the United States, to the Oval Office, and help us understand the significance and what to look for in these reports is Scott Harold, senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation. Scott, a very good evening to you. Prime Minister Suga, Yoshihide Suga. What is it that we're watching for in these next days after the visit, well, apparently very successful visit of our Japanese ally? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John and Gordon. Yes, so I think there are a number of things to keep an eye out for in the coming weeks. Several of them grow directly out of the takeaways from both the Rose Garden press conference and the summit, as well as several of the documents that were released. The things that the media has caught attention to or paid a lot of attention to, of course, the strong U.S.-Japan statement of alliance. The alliance is as ironclad as it's ever been. There is a warmth and a friendship between, as they characterized each other, Joe and Yoshi, suggesting a return to very warm personal relations between the top two leaders. There will certainly be a lot of Chinese pushback, and there is already, as I'm sure Gordon has seen over the weekend, several complaints from Beijing and its embassies that the U.S.-Japan alliance is putting pressure on their plans to try to privatize the South China Sea, the East China Sea, and conquer Taiwan, as well as claiming that the United States and Japan are interfering with China's domestic human rights abuses in Xinjiang and Hong Kong. I think you'll probably see some enhanced coordination ahead of the virtual climate summit that the U.S. president is organizing next week. And you should hopefully see some coordination to try to increase trilateral cooperation with the Republic of Korea ahead of the G7 that will be held in the United Kingdom in June. So those would be some of the areas where I think you may see some steps. You've also seen, of course, as the Prime Minister and the President announced, a return to the Mansfield program, the Mansfield Fellowship program that allows U.S. government officials to go to Japan and spend a year in residence. That's an important component of recapitalizing the expertise within the U.S. government on Japan across a variety of issue areas, including, for example, cooperation on advanced and emerging technologies, John, which is one of the last areas that they talked about in detail, where they want to work closely to provide new standards, market access, and competitiveness with Chinese products in the realms of artificial intelligence, 5G, quantum computing, and robotics.
Gordon, you have a question for Scott.
Scott, among analysts, there is this glass half empty, glass half full argument about Taiwan. At the summit, many had hoped for a strong statement on Taiwan. There was a statement. It broke new ground, but was not as strong as some had hoped. Where do you fall in this debate among analysts?
First, I think, Gordon, I would say, you know, the analysts who you're talking about, I think we're all in the same camp. Everyone in the U.S. and Japan who is a serious analyst wants the best for Taiwan and recognizes Taiwan's importance. Some hope for an even stronger, more forthright, more explicit statement of U.S.-Japan commitment to defend Taiwan. Others wonder about the possibility of perhaps a more quiet set of comments that simply say that Taiwan's security and the Taiwan Strait peace and stability are important to the U.S. and Japan, and that what really goes on in the back rooms is what matters more. I think if you've seen the reaction from the Chinese media over the weekend, they certainly got the message loud and clear. This is the first time the U.S. and Japan have mentioned Taiwan explicitly since 1969. There are complaints that the U.S. and Japan are incentivizing Taiwan to declare de facto and de jure independence. And so I think that Beijing knows very clearly after this summit that the U.S. and Japan are working hand in glove to try to ensure that China does not have a misimpression that it can attack Taiwan with impunity. With that said, everyone who knows and loves Taiwan, of course, wants to see the strongest possible statement on Taiwan's behalf. and I don't begrudge anyone who hoped to see an even more vocal statement. But I do think that from my perspective, at a minimum, we've crossed the threshold where Beijing knows that the U.S. and Japan are of the same view, and hopefully we can continue putting meat on the bones of deterring Chinese aggression towards Taiwan in the next weeks and months to come.
The Olympic Games. As everyone knows, Japan delayed the Olympic Games because of the vaccine and virus expectations in 2020. Japan is going forward, to my understanding, with the Summer Games, and there's concern about the virus in Japan and the vaccine. However, this attaches to the Winter Olympics of 2022. I don't see in the press release any mention of that. Do we know if it was discussed in any fashion, Scott?
I have, like you, John, not seen any formal discussion of the Olympic Games of 2022. Beijing's genocide and crimes against humanity in Xinjiang, as well as its repression in Hong Kong and its threats to its neighbors and its theft of intellectual property, make it an unappealing destination at most time, or at any time, but particularly while it's committing genocide. With that said, I think Tokyo was probably trying to be cautious since it doesn't want its own Olympic Games, which are already, as you noted, under siege from COVID, to be held at further risk. The North Koreans have already announced that they won't come. That's not necessarily the worst thing, but I suspect that if China were to withdraw because of a joint U.S.-Japan statement to the effect that they would condition participation in the 2022 games now, that would distract a bit. I think that's probably something that Tokyo might revisit this fall, but unlikely to be mentioned right now.
Gordon?
Scott, another issue is 5G rollout and supply chain resilience. Many had expected Prime Minister Suga and President Biden to talk about it. What did they say, and what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, they definitely did. It was one of the documents that they released together with a document on climate change that suggested that the two sides will work very closely on advancing standards for 5G, for a variety of other advanced technologies, and to protect supply chains that would enable the two countries to, in some sense, pull apart from reliance on China and to try to set global standards that China probably cannot meet, since Chinese firms are obliged to give any data that touches their servers to the Chinese Ministry of State Security. I think that some of those documents went into a little bit more depth, but I suspect that we'll really see the meat put on the bones when people from commerce and some of the other, you know, the Ministry of Economy, Trade and Industry in Japan get together to hash out what exactly they're looking to do to synchronize Tokyo and Washington's approaches on this issue. But I do think that that's definitely going to be one of the areas where in peacetime competition will be primarily over advanced technologies, standards, and international norms. And I think that's where you're going to see that head in the weeks and months ahead, Gordon.
The Quad, India, Australia, Japan, and the United States, seen as one of the great successes of these last years in dealing with the aggression from the People's Republic of China. Was there anything in these conversations that shaped the Quad in any different fashion? Any surprises about the cooperation between the four countries, Scott?
I don't think there's anything that was particularly surprising, John. I do think, you know, the Quad, India, Australia, were mentioned briefly in passing, certainly entirely favorably, mostly as examples of nations that share similar values, interests, and national security perspectives, working together to sustain a free and open Indo-Pacific. I think if there's a connection there, in particular to the last or preceding administration, the Trump administration, which openly embraced that phrasing, a free and open Indo-Pacific, it was the fact that the current U.S. administration and President Biden himself articulated a free and open Indo-Pacific as the standard. So I think that ties the two administrations or both parties in the U.S. to a shared perspective on the values that the U.S. holds dear in the Indo-Pacific region, which is freedom and openness. And, of course, Australia, a U.S. ally, India, a close U.S. partner, are both working together with Japan and the United States to try to promote and preserve that. I think what we have not yet seen is an explicit expansion or attempt to expand the Quad. And we may see some efforts in that direction when President Moon Jae-in visits next month to Washington, D.C. for his own summit. It's also possible that we may not see a formal expansion of the Quad. We may simply see issue-by-issue cooperation with fifth parties.
Scott Harold is a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation. Gordon Chang, at Gordon G. Chang, Gate Stone, Newsweek, and The Hill. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network.